Hello, everyone. This is Yulia. Welcome to Unpacking Zionism and our mini-series From Above, in which we look at Zionist political institutions. The foreground for this conversation and for all of our work is the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Israel is not only starving, literally starving Palestinians to death, deliberately, but is also massacring people who are desperate to get food and water at aid distribution sites. Israel has now seized the second international flotilla that was bringing aid to Gaza and detained 19 activists and 2 journalists who were on board. It is the reason for our work, to stop the genocide, to resist repression, and to fight Zionism, colonialism, and fascism. This episode is a bit different as it brings both regular hosts, me and Amaya Gelman, for a conversation. Hi, Amaya. Will you tell us what this episode is about?
Hi, Yulia. So we're doing this a little unusually. In this series, we have been looking at one Zionist institution at a time, and that's because even though Zionist organizations play a very, very big role in U.S. politics, they're really under-researched. Most journalists treat them as sort of representatives of Jewish political views, which is not only wrong, but also misses the way that as a group, Zionist organizations form a political infrastructure that's connected in all sorts of ways to state and capital power. By that, we're talking about being connected to the Israeli government and military and the United States government and military, which are represented on the boards, fiscal boards and advisory boards of many Zionist organizations. And we're also talking about their connections through boards, often to cyber tech and surveillance industries, which themselves are anchored in U.S. and Israeli corporations and linked to both militaries. We're also talking about the donor and mega donor class, which is tied into those firms and also to finance capital. And that class also plays a huge role in driving politics, funding and defunding universities, invoking police violence. So the reach is wide. And Zionist organizations are, because of that, political organizations of incredible consequence in genocide and fascism.
Most of the organizations we've covered so far purport to represent Jewish communities' opinions. But the one we're covering today is different. It's not about opinions. It's about putting the armed carceral muscle behind other organizations. We're talking about the Secure Community Network, SCN. In these episodes, we usually ask someone who's researched the organization to come talk about it. But there hasn't been much reporting on the Secure Community Network at all. What little there is has been mostly in the Jewish press from years ago. And we will list those references in the episode notes.
Yeah, Jewish press has been really important in doing these kinds of investigations. And mainstream press rarely pick up on that, interestingly. What has been in the news recently, mainly in the context of the Washington, D.C. shooting of 2 Israeli embassy employees in May of 2025, is the Nonprofit Security Grant Program, which we're going to call NSGP. That's a program that provides funding primarily to Jewish institutions. In fact, I'll go so far as to say Zionist institutions, because no one is directing that funding to leftist Jewish groups. And that funding is to harden their spaces, meaning to develop more militarized security practices, to develop direct links with police and federal law enforcement, and to train the leaders of those organizations on securitization. The NSGP is a war on terror funding stream that most recently had a budget of $500 million annually. And following the DC shooting, Zionist organizations called for it to be funded at $1 billion a year. And the Secure Community Network has everything to do with that.
So since there hasn't been much research on SCN, but it's still really important to cover it, especially for this podcast series, we're going to talk about it among ourselves, me and Amaya, using the research and reporting that's available to us. So let's get into it. Amaya, what do we know about the background of this organization? How and when did it emerge?
The background for the Secure Community Network and also the Nonprofit Security Grant Program is the war on terror itself.
The war on terror, meaning the open-ended campaign of militarism that George W. Bush declared in the wake of 9/11,
A first big push in the war on terror was the massive piece of legislation called the Patriot Act, which authorized the U.S. government to do all kinds of surveillance, detentions, and repression under the guise of emergency.
The war on terror produced this kind of chaotic pouring of funds into securitization through the federal government, through funding streams, often without much oversight. My favorite quote from Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11, is when he goes to John Conyers and he says, "What do you mean that Congress passed the Patriot Act without reading it?" And John Conyers says to him, "Sit down, my child." So that's the context for the war on terror funding streams that have beefed up securitization with billions of dollars, probably trillions of dollars at this point. The story of the nonprofit security grant program is that the Jewish Federations, which is the sort of charitable funding body that directs charitable funds that are raised largely from Jewish communities, Jewish Federations had hired a lobbyist who was looking for a way to direct more federal funding to the organizations within the Jewish Federations. And historically, those organizations have done things like social work or, you know, healthcare. They've actually been really important pieces of social infrastructure throughout the United States. And he was looking initially at, could there be transportation funding to get elderly people to their doctor's appointments? He was looking around for ways to drive funding to the federations. And this was at the moment when there was this sort of new upwelling of securitization funding. The Department of Homeland Security had just been created. It was 2003. And he theorized correctly that the one way to do it would be to tie the federations into war on terror funding. The federations, which were called United Jewish Communities at the time, I think, lobbied for security funding. They conducted a sort of political education and lobbying project, and they won the creation in 2004 of the nonprofit security grant program. And that was a funding stream that directed money to states to allocate as they saw fit to organizations that they thought might be at risk of whatever terrorist attack was. The criteria were extremely loosey-goosey. And because the federations had been involved in it, they were sort of first in line. And in fact, to some extent, only organizations in line. So for the first few years, this program had something like $10 to $12 million in funding that got sent to state agencies. The allocation requirements didn't require that there be an actual threat that somebody had made against the organization or that there was even any kind of credible knowledge of it, but rather just kind of the worry about it. And this is pretty typical of war on terror funding. So, for example, an attack on a synagogue in France could be a rationale for beefing up security for a Jewish organization in the United States, even though the context in France is very different. And the risk to an actual institution in the United States might not exist. It was simply a sort of concatenation of ideas. And it's important to note that that's how the anti-Semitism scare works in the United States. Like, we talk about anti-Semitism and the risk of harm in ways that are totally detached from the conditions that we are actually facing. So it's kind of a mirror of the war on terror itself, like an amorphous threat, not grounded in anything. And where it ended up was that these super vague criteria led to the construction of a perceived threat against Jewish institutions that was never based in anything, or even worse, was sometimes based in like the FBI cooking up threats against Jewish institutions, as, for example, in the Nuremberg sting, as it's called, the case where the FBI incited four people in Nuremberg, New York, to join with their own operative in a plot against a synagogue in Riverdale that they would have never instantiated if they hadn't been brought into it by their agent who secured the weapons, who offered to pay them for it, et cetera. So there's this sort of machinery of producing threat. In 2009, there was an article in a Syracuse, New York newspaper that critiqued the fact that 94% of this supposedly community funding went to Jewish organizations. And especially that was the case because there was an attack on a Sikh temple and there was no such funding, no such outreach to the temple. And in fact, the community didn't even know about it. So it's like, well, okay, there's this actual risk and the funding is not going into those organizations.
But at the time, it's also not just the funding that the Federation secured. They also created Secure Community Network. And a lot of this information comes from reporting by Josh Nathan Kazis, who was at the Jewish Forward at the time. So SCN, Secure Community Network, was created in 2004 and originally was intended to be an alert network. This new entity was meant to notify Jewish organizations of pertinent security threats. Quickly after being founded as a network to send out alerts, SCN pivoted to providing training sessions and webinars to Jewish groups. On their website, SCN says about its mission, and I quote, "Nearly two decades ago, we created the Secure Community Network to provide us with expertise on safety and security, to coordinate directly with federal law enforcement, and develop best practices to support local efforts." So Secure Community Network was created by Jewish federations. It was headed by a security professional who was already networked with the Department of Homeland Security, private security, etc. And by 2013, when Nathan Kazis is writing about it, SCN itself had become part of national security infrastructure, with its CEO named to an increasingly prestigious position on Department of Homeland Security Advisory Board, and also culminating in a three-year appointment to the Homeland Security Advisory Council. All of this is coming from Nathan Kazis' reporting. On the board of directors of Secure Community Network, we see heads of major Jewish organizations. At the time, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Orgs, which is a coordinating body that gathers major Jewish organizations, major Zionist organizations, to speak with a sort of unified voice into the White House's ear. And what's important about Secure Community Network is that it's run as a charity, but it also pays millions of dollars to private security contractors. It also has ties through its director and collaborators to major security firms. It also secured millions of dollars in in-kind services for local organizations. So all of this is ballooning up by 2013.
That's why it's important to understand Zionist organizations as an infrastructure and not just a bunch of different organizations, because the fact that the Jewish Federations was able to secure through its lobbying this funding stream was matched with the fact that there was a network of organizations that was sort of anchored and supported by technical assistance to apply for these grants, not only to apply for them, but to apply with a sort of insider view to how they're going to be allocated, and for the lobbying to continue to budget and to fund the grant program put forward by lobby groups that are already connected to power. So it's not incidental that this funding stream was created at the same time as an organization to make sure that the funding was directed in the way that the Jewish federations wanted it to.
So after 2013, there really isn't much reporting about Secure Community Network for a few years. What do we know about what the organization is up to then?
So the rise of the Trump era really changed the conversation. When Trump started running for president, the way that that empowered white nationalists really changed the conversation about anti-Semitism. So the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally was in 2017, and we had already been seeing lots of racist and anti-Semitic expression from white nationalists. And when we say white nationalists, that actually includes like a multiracial white nationalist crew that has started to rise. And the actual march itself in Charlottesville really put white nationalism and anti-Semitism on like a shocking display. White nationalists were willing to show themselves, consider themselves mainstream, and instantiate violence, including anti-Semitic violence. And it's really the sort of shocking moment of the Charlottesville march was partly all these white frat boys carrying tiki torches, but then the murder at the march of Heather Heyer. The violence, the willingness to articulate these racist views in public and be seen with them was really shocking. And concerns about anti-Semitism escalated along with the sense that white nationalists were going to instantiate racist and anti-immigrant violence. Funding poured into the organizations that were understood to oppose anti-Semitism, right? And those organizations, like we talk a lot about the Anti-Defamation League is one of those organizations, which got like $1 million in donations in the week following the Charlottesville rally. The organizations that had set themselves up as anti-Semitism organizations are right-wing organizations, right? That this is something that people have come to realize more in the last 2 years, but these were not organizations that were protecting all Jews. They were not organizations that were interested in the broad spectrum of anti-racism. Their interest in fighting anti-Semitism was specifically a right-wing interest, as we've seen in advancing the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, which criminalizes essentially at this point criticism of Israel and discussion about the Israeli genocide in Palestine. So funding poured into these right-wing organizations out of concern over right-wing anti-Semitism, which is sort of a mismatch, right? A narrative mismatch. It also poured into the nonprofit security grant program. The funding for that program had been about $10 to $13 million a year over the prior years. It had gone up and down. It jumped to $25 million in the year following the Charlottesville March. And then after the Pittsburgh shooting, it jumped to $60 million. By 2024, the nonprofit security grant program was being funded at $454 million a year. So we just need to think about, like, what does that mean in terms of, like, what is it doing? That's $454 million in new security cameras, hardening the perimeter of these organizations, in contracting with guard services, right? This is physical infrastructure of securitization. And we know there's no such thing as anti-racist securitization. It's all carceral, and carceral stuff targets people of color first, immigrants first, Palestinians first in this case. So there's not a lot of reporting on exactly how that went down. And in fact, it's perhaps more dangerous to have an unreported and uninterrogated bump in security funding. We saw it again come into the news in 2022 after the Colleyville shooting, because the rabbi who managed to disarm the gunman credited his ability to do that to having been trained through the Secure Community Network. And that just amplified it a million times more.
You know, Colleyville is the first that I heard about the Secure Community Network. And we see that the reputation of the org and the funding for NSGP skyrocket after Colleyville, even though this case is really not evidence of its effectiveness. I'll quote from a report by a policy and strategy think tank, the New Lines Institute. The report is dedicated to assessing the nonprofit security grant program after Colleyville. And it's kind of skeptical about the role of the grant in the Colleyville case. They write, I quote, "However, it did not appear to prevent the hostage-taking incident at Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, which was a recipient of NSGP fund in 2020. Instead, Rabbi Charlie credited the security training he received with helping to save himself and his fellow captive congregants. It isn't clear if Congregation Beth Israel had an opportunity to implement its intended security upgrades prior to the hostage-taking incident. An armed guard was not present at the time of the incident." End of quote. I'm focusing on this not to advocate for these measures, but to highlight that no matter the actual evidence, it just gets incorporated into the narrative about the effectiveness of the Secure Community Network and NSGP-funded security measures.
Colleyville is also the first place that I heard about the Secure Community Network, and it's really notable that it had already been in existence for 18 years by that point, and, you know, probably $100 million in funding had already gone into it. And we just heard about it in the context of the rabbi's story. But after that, the story of Colleyville really became central in the rise of the Secure Community Network as kind of a public story that advanced the need for securitization. But it was also a turn because it was not a white supremacist. It was somebody who was trying to secure the release of Afia Siddiqui, the prisoner in the United States who was arrested in Afghanistan in relation to the U.S. war there. After Colleyville, the narrative in the United States really shifted. You know, the post of White House anti-Semitism czar had been vacant for a long time. And in 2022, finally, Biden, under pressure related to this whole sort of narrative, hired Deborah Lipstadt into that position. And Deborah Lipstadt is a notorious Islamophobe and proponent of the IRA definition. And her employment there led to the White House plan to combat anti-Semitism, which is really the only such plan that the White House ever generated, really a policing and public narrative plan. In the world of public policy studies, we say that budgets are an ideological map, right? So the nonprofit security grant program shows exactly how that's working. The Secure Community Network is the organization to kind of knit together the infrastructure of Zionist organizations and the securitization infrastructure in the United States. And then it gets stitched into this public discourse about anti-Semitism, which began with white nationalism and has quickly shifted to we need to police the left, even though the left is anti-racist, often made up of Jews, right? And trying to, at this point in time, secure the end of a genocide that's in violation of every principle, every international law. And now we have this multi-billion dollar funding stream directed against that. So we often learn about the Secure Community Network late. We learn about its partnerships and its presence in particular spaces after it's already been there for a while. We're seeing now in 2025 that it has announced partnerships with Hillel, the Foundation to Combat Antisemitism. We'll come to that in one second. Taking that as a starting point, how can we look backward a little bit and try and understand what their role has been in the policing of anti-genocide protests, particularly at universities?
Yeah, even though there isn't a lot of reporting, what we're seeing is that university administrators and university police do collaborate with other state agencies. We know from FOIA requests that in 2024, for example, the Yale Police Department was in collaboration with the FBI, monitoring and surveilling students and faculty and anti-genocide organizers and protesters. The Yale Police Department also collaborated with other law enforcement agencies and even a federal counterterrorism intelligence sharing center in its effort to crack down on protests. And from reporting in Jewish Currents that we'll link to, we also learned that Yale Police Department officers received briefings from the Secure Community Network. The SCN reached out directly to the Yale Police Department, as well as the FBI, and had the Yale Police Department chief promise in an email to keep the SCN posted with any updates. That's a direct quote. So what does it mean that the Secure Community Network is this kind of partner between the state and the university in policing, surveilling, and repressing anti-genocide protesters?
We know about this model that has really surfaced in university after university since the beginning of the genocide, which is that Zionist organizations in various ways come into universities, sort of push in from outside to offer advice or quote-unquote support for what they themselves have constructed as a crisis of campus anti-Semitism. We've seen it, for example, with the Academic Engagement Network, which we always have to say is a project of the Israel on Campus Coalition, but presents itself as a campus climate consultant coming in to advise university administrations on how to, quote unquote, protect Jewish students. Of course, they only mean Zionist Jewish students, or how to, quote unquote, protect freedom of speech, by which they mean actually limit freedom of speech, right? You can check out our other episode on the Academic Engagement Network. So there's this model by which Zionist organizations come in at the top level of university administrations to provide advice in a Zionist vein. And so when we see the Secure Community Network doing that at Yale, you have to wonder, what else are they doing? So with Yale, one of the other conflagrations that happened over the course of the repression of anti-genocide protests was that a scholar there, a legal scholar, Hila Dotahi, was fired on the basis of a story that was published about her by an AI-generated newspaper that says it's a Jewish newspaper, that essentially leveraged the same kind of charges at her that have been lobbed at people who speak out against the genocide everywhere, that they're, you know, supported with or affiliated with terror organizations. There's no reporting that links that case to the Secure Community Network. But that doesn't mean that the Secure Community Network wasn't part of it, right? Because the way that Zionist organizations have constructed their relationship with university administrators is by pointing out to them that they may be at risk of something, right? You may be at risk of your Jewish students are in danger. You're at risk of being the subject of a Title VI lawsuit. You know, you're at risk of various things. And so we're going to help you manage your risk. Well, Secure Community Network does exactly the same thing. We're going to help you manage your risk. And you can only imagine that in a context where the university is being accused or threatened with being connected with somebody who has quote unquote support for terror on their resume, that the university itself is trying to manage its risk by sanitizing itself, basically expunging that person and excising the risk. Well, having an organization that has a direct line to the FBI, to the Department of Homeland Security, would certainly be part of that. So again, there's no research that names the two of those things happening together. But the way that we have come to understand how Zionist organizations have entered into the world of university policy suggests that if we don't look for that, we're delusional, right? We're missing something very important. We don't know what other universities have partnered with Secure Community Network, but that's coming up now, right? There's an increasing push by the organizations that work with universities to partner with Secure Community Network.
We now see a public announcement about a collaboration and partnership between the Secure Community Network, Hillel International, and Foundation to Combat Antisemitism in launching this program that they called Safe U, Campus Safety Initiative. And it's a training program that's ostensibly designed to equip Jewish university students with first aid skills and situational awareness. But in press releases and kind of public-facing statements, the Safe U program is explicitly linked to repressing anti-genocide protests and organizing that mushroomed on U.S. university campuses. So Secure Community Network, like many other Zionist organizations, tracked so-called incident reports and activity on university campuses and filed them under anti-Semitism incidents, even though they are explicitly anti-Zionist, anti-genocide organizing protests and encampments. But now these so-called incidents have become a kind of justification and the context in which Safe U presents to be a training curriculum that is so necessary to ensure safety of Jewish, but in fact Zionist students on campus. So this program is about raising awareness and vigilance in everyday settings, and it's a kind of militarized security training. It's a pretty new development, and we haven't seen it being implemented yet, but it's something to keep an eye on.
It also suggests to us that there are other partnerships between those organizations that are not being necessarily made public. So for example, Hillel and the Foundation to Combat Antisemitism have made overtures to university administrators in the last couple of months, offering to help them surveil social media on their campuses to help predict or keep tabs on what they might interpret as anti-Semitism, again, meaning anti-Zionism, or the possibility that there might be further disturbances on campus as students call for divestment from war industries and call for an end to genocide. Those organizations themselves are part of a larger surveillance network. There are lots of connections between Zionist organizations in the United States and Israeli tech firms like Cyberwell. The Combat Antisemitism movement also integrates surveillance firms with anti-Semitism watchdogging. It's important to note also how completely this security discourse is focused on students protesting the genocide. Like, if you look at the materials for these organizations, when they talk about what the threat is, it's literally students protesting the genocide. This is now the move from a war on terror framework into an anti-Palestinian racism carceral framework into a Trump fascism where both security concerns and anti-Semitism concerns are instrumentalized by people who care about neither one of those as a way to instantiate fascism. So it's really consequential. We talk a lot about how anti-Semitism narrative is moving into fascism. And here we have the hardware of securitization being mobilized by the same forces.
The Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism has itself been a target of this kind of effort to silence by leveraging the security and carceral power of the state. Emeya, what happened when we announced that we were working on a research project studying connections between Zionist organizations?
We were threatened by the Lawfare Project, essentially under its alt, which is End Jew Hatred, that they had reported us to the Secure Community Network, which of course is code for we've reported you to the federal government and law enforcement. So these are not incidental to us. We're all affected by this. And actually, the more that we see vigilantism using the power of the fascist state to attack, whether it's student protesters, whether it's immigrants subjecting immigrant student organizers to deportation proceedings, or whether it's organizations that study and report on the way that Zionism is working, they're really leveraging quite material forces against all of us. So, Yulia, where does this stand? We began with the Washington, D.C. shooting, which produced another round of calls for securitization, among other things that it called for, were laws that established some massive buffer zone around every Zionist institution so that people could never protests near it. And it also called for ramping up the nonprofit security grant program. So where do we stand?
The DC shooting is a moment where over 40 American Jewish Zionist, we should say, groups and organizations coalesced around a call for more funding to beef up the nonprofit security grant program. The ask was to basically quadruple the budget and raise it to $1 billion. But as a result of this request, a bipartisan group of 130 House members asked the Congress to provide $500 million for the budget of NSGP in 2026. So this is in a direct response to a request from these Jewish Zionist groups and organizations to beef up security funding. So incidents that especially catch media attention become central in perpetuating the narrative of anti-Semitism threats, but also in securing funding for and the reproduction of this infrastructure of Zionist and state security apparatus.
I'll mention also that at the time that the Trump administration froze grant funding, which of course included this kind of funding, that funding freeze is overturned by advocacy by Zionist organizations. So we can see that not only is there an escalation of funding, but it's also not going to be subject in the same way as other kinds of funding to the vagaries of the Trump administration. This is a right-wing project. I'm going to ask you a last question because I think we're at the end of the reporting that's available to us, which is we've seen Project Esther become the playbook for repression of Palestine solidarity movement, repression of the left, the rationale for withdrawal of rights and for the criminalization of protest. And what you just said, that more than 130 House members on both sides of the aisle called for this escalation in funding to the nonprofit security grant program. What's your assessment of how this narrative is working to sort of recruit liberal, quote unquote, liberal or democratic support to the project of right-wing militaristic fascism and or Zionism?
I mean, it just reveals the liberal participation in the project of empire. Both parties and last year, both presidential candidates were equally committed to continuing to fund Israeli genocide of Palestinians. The panic over this invented anti-Semitism crisis just serves as convenient cover for liberal politicians to do the bidding of the empire.
Our usual last question when we're talking about these things is how do we resist, right? I think the somewhat unsatisfactory answer is that we invest in our movements. The same kind of work that's needed to resist ICE, the same kind of work that's needed to resist the expansion of prisons, that's the work that's needed to resist Zionist militarism in the United States. We actually have lots of episodes where we've talked about various kinds of resistance. Our episode on the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which was an interview with the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, has some of that, as do many of the other episodes. And also, this is the point of connection between anti-Zionist movement, abolitionism, and the broader resistance to fascism. They're all connected.
This is all we got on the Security Community Network so far. So this is the end of this episode. We hope to see more reporting on it in the future. It's a really significant player in the political arena, and we need to know how it operates.
As we wrap up the series From Above, and as we wrap up for the moment our keyword series on unpacking Zionism, we might do a little going back and forth. To round out this conversation, we're going to post a keywords episode next week on securitization with Nicole Wynn. That should help frame out some of the context that allowed this to happen and also help us understand how we push back.
So please check out the resources we linked in the episode notes and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss new episodes. Until next time, solidarity from the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism.